Okay, welcome everybody. We're going to have a class on the subject of the Seder. I think that the Seder is probably one of the most difficult mitzvahs to do properly. It's a very, very challenging, very, very difficult. Ideally, it's supposed to be a night in which everybody is engaged. And there should be room for spontaneity. There should be real discussion. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way. And I will talk about that a little bit. There's a number of difficulties with regard to the Seder. One of them is practical, in that there's so much work going on. Everybody, by the time you get there to do the Seder, especially the women, I always feel a certain sympathy for the women, you know, you're basically exhausted. I one time said that, I mean, it's not up to me to decide these things, but it would have been, at least in my imagination, it would have been a good time to have the Seder the next morning. Do all the preparation and get everything set, and then you're exhausted. So the first glass of wine, you know, you fall asleep. Then the next morning when you're refreshed would be the good time. But of course, my opinion doesn't count for anything on these things. That's the way it was ordained. It has to be that night. So I think that first and foremost, it is important in your preparations for Pesach, not just to do all the physical labor, but to be able to set aside a time where you could just relax. To see, get everybody to help. Everybody should help out. And hopefully, it's Monday night. Hopefully by Monday morning or whatever Monday afternoon you like, you can really take a nap or whatever it is and relax, and everything is prepared so you're not harried when you get there. That itself is a very important factor, to prepare yourself psychologically and mentally for the Seder. Okay, but the second issue is there's a few issues over here because you're having guests for the Seder, so then there's all different kinds of personalities. There are some people that want to talk more. There are some people that are hungry and they want to get to the food. So that's another thing for the Seder leader to try and have a certain control. But I think that the biggest problem is, what would you say is the biggest problem? The biggest problem, I think, is the Haggadah. The Haggadah itself is not easy. It's not easy. And the whole point is that it's supposed to be a night when we're engaged, and we read about these rabbis that were all night long, they couldn't stop talking, and then you read the Haggadah and it becomes very, very difficult. So I'm going to try and give you a bit of an overview. I can't go through everything. I can't go through all the specifics. It's just too much for one session. I'm going to try and give you like an overview to sort of set you up and to make it a little bit easier, to have a meaningful Seder. And hopefully, I think the Seder leader should come to the Seder prepared with certain talking points. Certain talking points, because the point is really to engage the audience. First and foremost, who's the most important person at the Seder? Who's the most important person at the Seder? The child. Because the mitzvah, this is the night when we're supposed to recount the story of the Exodus. But we're supposed to incorporate it into that mitzvah, says, V'higar to Levincha, you shall teach it to your children. So this is the night where the whole purpose really is God designated one night of the year when we're supposed to transmit the so-called Masorah, what we've received, that we're supposed to transmit to the next generation. This is the night. So the most important person is really the child. And that's why the Haggadah itself incorporates the educational philosophy, which we'll get to. Judaism has its own educational philosophy. So that's very, very important. And that's the same reason the child, you know, depending on the age of the child, to prepare treats and all of that, make sure the kid has a nap, whatever it is, hopefully, whatever he can partake of. If he can partake of 15 minutes, that's important. And even children that are not really, I discussed it, even if they're not that advanced intellectually, the drama of the evening, the fact that the Judaism places a lot of stress on unconscious impressions in childhood. Even before you fully understand. Formal chinuch education begins when the child can understand. But there's another chinuch that's very, very important. It pays to make this point. For example, the rabbis said that one should give out treats on Shabbos to little children, candies and things of that sort. Even children that don't even understand what Shabbos is. What's the reason for that? Because they understood the power of the unconscious mind. There are certain things that you enjoyed. It's interesting. There's certain things that I saw this in my own life. There's certain things that I enjoy as an adult, and I can't really explain why I enjoy it until I traced it back. For example, I love the ocean. I like the mountains, but I like the ocean even better. I like to be, that's the only thing that's lacking over here. There's no ocean. I used to live near the ocean in Far Rockaway, right over the bridge. There was, you know, I love the ocean. I didn't, why? Yeah, that's why I just happened to like it. No, the answer is I traced it back. In childhood, my parents used to go, take us, we'd go to Rockaway from the city, go to the, and there was the ocean. So I associated, I'd get out of school, which I disliked intensely as a kid, early, and then, you know, like I associated all those pleasant, like that was like heaven, it was freedom. So that made an impression on my unconscious. There's many, so if Shabbos, that's why it's very, very important. If the child, even when he's very, very young, if he senses a joy from the Shabbos and it's, you know, the parents are happy, it's a great time, he doesn't know why, but it'll leave a certain unconscious association. Come Shabbos, he'll feel good about it. He won't even know why. You see, of course, as he learns more, you'll fill in the missing blanks. So it's very, very important, the Seder too. Even if he's a little child and he doesn't understand anything, but the excitement, the drama, everybody got so, that'll make an impression on his unconscious mind. So that's very important. Certainly, we're talking about children that are old enough to participate. That's very, very important to, that they come first, I would say. So you're going to have a Seder which revolves around children, but, you know, children can take so much. Don't overdo it. And then, of course, adults. I'm going to try and gear this so that you can have a more meaningful Seder vis-a-vis the children and vis-a-vis the adults as well. Okay? Now, in terms of the children, you really want to get them to ask questions. That's not, most of the kids will come home with scripts. I don't know if they still do that. I remember my kids would come home, they'd have something, right? That they would, so they're supposed to just read it. They would just read it. That never really appealed to me. All right, if that's the, you know, that's what they're doing, fine. But that's not the point. The point is really, I try to get them involved by a lot of prizes for questions, a good question. Get them to ask a good question. If they make a good comment, a good observation, I think that's very good. You know, to give them points, make up some kind of a game. So that's always going to keep people involved, especially kids, you know. And for a good question, you get really a lot. A good question is the best. And if I ask a question, I get a decent, any kind of answer is a good answer, because I can take anything they say and develop a conversation with it. You want to get them involved. So use all those devices to get them involved. We'll see how that's incorporated into the Seder itself. Parenthetically, last year, this is the first time I did this, I had people over from, you know, my shul. Somebody had become religious, but the children hadn't, because he became religious later in life. Whatever the case is, these are like teens from, say, 12 to 15, and I wanted to get them involved. So what I did was I made up games. This is the first time I did this. Passover pyramid. Did you ever see that until, you know... what's it called? Password, right? I'm pyramid, right? And I had my son, my 17-year-old son, was there, and we had the teams, two against two, and I didn't do it the whole time. You got to do the. We'd stop and play some Passover pyramid. I worked out all these with Jewish terms or categories. You know how the game is played. For example, the category would be one of the categories. Let's say you're why you join a shul, okay? That's, and your partner has to guess. That's the category. So you give very, because you want to daven, whatever it is, you, things like that. I made up a bunch of cards, and I could pass them around later. Different names of people. What do they have in common? Important characters in Jewish history. Things of that sort. And, you know, they would keep score. So that kept them interested. Take a break. Let's 5 minutes. We play the game, and then we go back. That kept them very. It worked very, very well. So things like that. If you could devise things like that, I think it's perfectly fine. Okay. Now let's do the Haggadah. Let's do. I want to give you an overview to demystify the. Haggadah. Okay. The Haggadah revolves around the four cups of wine. The four cups of wine are very, very important because it's a expression of the fact that we're celebrating our freedom. Okay. It's part of the objective is to demonstrate that we're free people. So basically everything we're doing on that night is going to fall into one of the four cups of wine. Okay? Of course, the basic mitzvah of the night is to retell, Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, to retell the story of the Exodus, and we do it in many, many ways. We do it through talking about it. We do it through illustration. That's why you have the Seder plate, all the various objects. Illustration is very, very important. And whatever other illustrations you can find for a little child to show them what it means, what a slave is, what a slave's life is like. Also through eating, interestingly enough. As we'll see, the mitzvos that we do that night, especially eating certain foods which carry a message, is also a form of telling a story. So you have, again, the abstract, telling the story, you have the illustration, and you have the eating. Okay, now, all right, so you set the plate. I think everybody, knows what has to go on the plate. I don't have to go into that. The first coast, the first cup, is Kiddush. Okay, so that's pretty standard, because that sanctifies the evening. It's a Yom Tov like any other Yom Tov. So you fill up the first of the four cups of wine. By the way, also, I think this is an important point, that because the wine is an expression of the fact that we're free and we're celebrating, it's a good idea that each person should drink a wine that they like, that they really enjoy. So if you're having guests, what I will do is I'll ask them what kind of wines. You should drink some. Some people don't like this wine. It's contrary to the idea that you're drinking wine and you're sort of forcing yourself, you're not enjoying it. So it's fully in line with the idea that on this night you drink something that you would really drink to celebrate. It could be a champagne, it could be a white wine, red wine. Red wine is preferable, but only if you like it better. So in advance, make sure you have a wine that you enjoy.
Is grape juice allowed?
Grape juice is allowed if you can't drink wine. If you can't drink wine.
89-year-old woman?
Yeah, of course. Grape juice is allowed. But to begin with, I'm saying that since the point is the celebration, you would celebrate over a fine wine, unless it's bad for your health or you can't drink it or something like that, obviously. That goes without saying. Okay, so the first is the Kiddush. Now, you make the Kiddush sitting down at the table, of course. You don't stand up. The only time I stand up is on Friday night for the first part of the Kiddush, okay, which I've explained. Now, when you drink, this is important to know, when you drink the wine and when you eat certain foods, you're going to do it in what state? In a reclining state. Why do we recline? Anyone know why we recline? Anybody know why we recline? Oh boy, I wish I got a table with you people. I have a lot of fun. I want to have a seder with people that I can, that haven't heard it before. Yeah, so that's the reclining. The mitzvah is to recline. What is reclining, though? How do you recline? Reclining, first of all, has to be on the left side, right? You know that. Now, would this be good? Would this be good? No. You have to recline by leaning on something. So, if you have the handle of a chair, you should lean on that. You can't just lean over to the left and drink. That's not called reclining. Reclining means your hand has to rest on something. If this is the only kind of chair you have, you can do this. Rabbi Soloveitchik demonstrated this. I saw. You can do this. You can lean on your neighbor's knee. They don't object. I'm serious. That's what the Gemara says. When the rabbis got together and they sat in there, like I guess, on the floor, each one would lean on the other person's knee. But you got to be careful who's sitting next to you. That could be dangerous. So.
And that applies to women as well.
That's a whole discussion about women, that should women do reclining as well. I think it's a good idea for women to do reclining as well. Yeah, that's how we do it. But I think there's an option. If a woman doesn't want to, that's okay. But it's better, in my opinion. Okay, so now we got that out of the way. Okay, what comes next? What comes after Kadesh? Okay, Urachatz. This is very interesting. Rachatz. And, you wash your hands without a bracha. What are we washing our hands for? For karpas. Okay? What's the purpose of karpas? While you're doing the Seder, you should really ask these questions. Like, why are we doing this now? Why are we having, what is the karpas? It's the vegetable. Okay? This usually celery, I guess. Some people use potato, cooked potato, right? What do you guys use?
Parsley.
Parsley?
They even said it in the
Maxwell House. Celery, no?
Parsley?
How can you eat parsley? Is that edible?
Seeds.
I do celery. All right, you guys can do parsley. It's up to you. I do.
Too easy for everyone.
I never ate parsley. Parsley is something you put in the soup, isn't it? I don't know.
It's a garnish.
All right, whatever you want. I know it says parsley. Boy, you people are really, you play it by the book. You're very strict. But what's the point? Why are we doing this? What's the reason for the karpas? This is very, very fascinating. So nobody knows. Good. So I'm not going to tell you. You'll come to my Seder and you'll find out.
A
what?
A sign of spring?
No, it's not a sign of spring. It's something very, very mundane. It's so the child will ask. It's simply there to arouse the curiosity of the child. Why are we eating a vegetable at this point? Why are we eating a vegetable at this point? It's for the child. It's to arouse the curiosity of the child, doing something different that you normally don't do. Now, that's very, very important. What are you supposed to do after you have the vegetable? Part of karpas, there's the institution of karpas. You have it on page 7. You see? Karpas? The leader dips a small piece of parsley or another vegetable into
Rabbi Holland said the same thing.
Salt water, right? Distributes to all, and you say the blessing. But they left something out. They left something out. There's another part to karpas, which is very, very important. At that point, you're supposed to take the plate off the table. Removal of the plate, of the Seder plate. You're supposed to take it off. Again, to arouse the... What?
It's in the book. It's just on the bottom.
Oh, it's on the bottom. Okay. Okay. Because this is the time to do things. You're supposed to make changes, to do things that will arouse the curiosity of the child. So he'll ask, why are you taking, you know, you should really do it like you're with, as though we're finished eating. So you're supposed to do changes at that point in time. Now, these are the objective changes that are ordained, but we try to be creative. You could do any, at this point in time, you should do anything unusual so the child will ask. Every year we try to come up with different changes, crazy things. For example, one time I put on surgical gloves. Now, that's going to get the attention of the child, right? Why are you doing that? So, because this night is different. Why am I doing it? Because then I don't have to wash. For example, everybody can get up and wash, but there's a halacha that if you don't have to wash. Let's say you're traveling somewhere and you have sandwiches that you can't wash. Okay? You can't wash. So what do you do? Well, you can wear surgical gloves because you're not obligated to wash unless if you're touching the food. But if your hands are wrapped up, so then you don't have to do all until you're done. You don't have to wash. Just make a moti. That's what I do when we go traveling in the car. We travel. You know, we drove from New York. So you don't always have bottles of water. I'm not going to wash in the car and get the car all wet. So take out the gloves. I one time did it on an airplane. They thought it was crazy, the stewardess, you know, because washing in the bathroom over there, it's a whole problem. So I'm just suggesting do something ridiculous or change the seat. Let's say you sit where your husband normally sits. Like, why? Why are you doing this? Oh, because this night is just to arouse the curiosity of the child. And you can be very creative about that. The Rambam says that. They used to take matzah and pass it one around the room, things like that. So bear in mind that the idea of karpas is ordained as a change. Okay? So the official change is the vegetable and the removal of the plate. So the child will ask, why are you taking away the plate? We just started eating. You, however, that'll work the first year, but the next year you try and do something different. Okay? So that's the arousal of the curiosity of the child. The breaking of the matzah. What's the purpose of the breaking of the matzah? What's the purpose of the breaking of the matzah? That is to say, I said that the recitation is with illustration. Okay? The illustration is the matzah. That the matzah is broken. Because this is the bread of affliction. This is the poor person's bread. Which we're going to be saying halach manya. This is, you see, you break the matzah and then you give an explanation. Everything you do tonight, it has to be with an explanation, with reason, with understanding. as opposed to other times where very often we just do the mitzvah and we don't explain, although you should, but here it's mandatory to explain that this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt, and whoever is hungry should come and eat. Whoever is this, by the way, this could engender a great discussion. I'm not telling you what to do. You see, at any point in time, you can have a great discussion, because let's say the child will ask, what do you mean, now we are here, next year may we be in Israel? Why? Well, we can go to Israel. This made sense maybe 100 years ago. It made sense. We were praying for Israel, right? But we have Israel now. Why are we saying this? Let's say the kid asks that. That's what we want. In good seders that I've had, you know, everybody's encouraged. So the kid asks a question like that. That's credit. That's extra credit. That's a very good question. And then it says, now we are slaves. Next year may we be free. Well, what do you mean now we are slaves? I thought we're free. Aren't we free? What is the Agoda saying that now we are slaves? Is that true? We're not slaves. I mean, we were taken out of Egypt. And we're living in America. So why are we saying that? It's not true. We're not slaves. That's a pretty good discussion. That's what I would... Now, I would prompt the kid with that. If the kid is old enough to understand it, I would say, well, what are you saying? I'd have him read it. Now he goes, no. And I'd say, well, what do you mean? What did you just say? Now, are you a slave? I don't think the kids in America today are slaves. You know? With all the stuff, the gadgets and the iPods and all. Well, who's a slave? So that's... I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to tell you what to answer if they challenge you. I'm just going to prompt them. I'm going to tell them secretly. I'll tell them to ask you these questions. That's to engender. But then you have to have a discussion. So you start. So what do you do? Don't think that you have to have the answers. Someone mentioned, we don't have the. Don't think you have to have all the answers in advance. Think about it. Have a discussion. And even if whatever you achieve, if you had a good discussion about something, don't worry. Okay. All right, unless you want to bring me to your Seder, and I'll give answers. I'll give some. I don't know how good they'll be, but I'll try and give it. But don't worry about that. The best Seders I've had have been real live, real-time discussions, not just scripts. Okay? Okay. Now, as you know, the child asks, because the child, his curiosity has been aroused, and he asks, and we have the Manishtana. Okay, the Manishtana is delineating the four ways in which this night is different. Okay, what are the four ways in which it's different? Well, pertaining to the mitzvos, that we eat matzah, that we can't eat chametz and we must eat matzah. Okay, and this is an outline. In the course of the evening, all of these things will be explained to us, hopefully. This is sort of, the Haggadah at this stage is just presenting an outline of the evening. The other is the maror, the bitter herbs. The other one is the dipping, the two dippings. One is the dipping we just did, the karpas. What's the second dipping? The second dipping. There are two dippings. What's the second dipping? The maror, the bitter herbs, is going to be dipped into the charoses. That's going to be later on. Okay? So, That's the third question. Now, the third question pertains to the idea of telling the story of the Exodus, because that's the purpose of the dipping. The purpose of the dipping is to arouse the curiosity, so we recite the story. Now, the fourth question will pertain to what I just mentioned, the reclining. That the night is different because we recline. And what is reclining? Reclining means that we don't just tell the story in the abstract, but we demonstrate. Demonstration. You're supposed to demonstrate the reality, the fact that we were free. So these are the four questions. Okay. Yes?
At the top of the page, this is where it says the Seder plate is removed from the table.
Yeah.
At the four questions.
At the top of the four verses.
Right. Because that's the end of Karpas. Okay? Yeah, that's the end of... In other words, what you do is like this. You eat the vegetable. Okay? You break the matzah. That's the way they have it. You break the matzah. It's all part of karpas. And then once you break the matzah, you then have to explain what the matzah is about. The idea is that this is the bread of affliction. So you're defining what matzah is and why it's here. Okay? Then you remove the plate in order to stimulate the question. That's why they have it right before the Manishtana. Okay? Hopefully, I mean, it's not always going to work out that way necessarily. But that's the point. The point of the removal of the plate is to stimulate the question. What I would do, I would try to get one of the kids to help me remove the plate, because that he's more likely to notice that you got to make sure that whatever you're doing should be noticed. So, you know, like, can we get rid of the plate or something like that? Then the kid, well, why are we getting rid of the plate? Yeah. Why?
Why is the youngest child picked?
Picked for what?
Say the minus.
That's a good question. The Rambam actually didn't. There's an issue as to whether these are four questions or four statements. The Rambam did not have this as the question of the child. Of course, the question of the child should be whatever the child asks. And then the Rambam had the adult, the leader, would read the four questions to just give an outline of the four ways in which this night is different. But that's not. But others maintain that it, that it's a question that this should be asked by a child. The reason why it would be the youngest child, I would say, why would anybody, that's a good question. By the way, that's a good question for the Seder.
They're the ones that are learning.
Right, because...
They're the ones that want to be picked to do it because they know that, you know, they're the youngest ones, so they've got to practice off. You know, it's like a special thing to motivate the youngest ones to want to learn.
Correct. But all that, what you've all said, is very, very good. Because since the mitzvah is to teach it, you want to teach it to someone who knows the least. That's the idea. To give over the heritage to someone that doesn't have it. So that's the most. But you're not excluding the other children, but that gets them into the...
And that builds memories.
That builds memories. Yeah. So, okay. Now, we have it up to the four questions. Now, What's the next phase? No, they're not. Now, what's Avadim Hayinu? It's interesting. What is Avadim Hayinu is not the answer to the child's question, that we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and God took us out with a mighty hand, and so on. That paragraph is very, very important. It is not the answer to the question at all. It's a very short answer. If that's the answer, that's not the answer, because you see, it goes on and it says that even if we're all wise, even if we're all elders, even if we know the Torah, it's a mitzvah for us to tell the story of the Exodus. From this point on, at this point in time, the Haggadah becomes a guidebook, a manual. It's telling you how to conduct the Seder. In other words, the instructions for the evening are contained in the Haggadah itself. Well, how so? Avadim Hayinu is explaining to us why we have the mitzvah to tell the story. It's not giving you the answer. It's telling you, why are we having a Seder altogether? Why do I have to tell the story? Oh, because the reason is contained right here. Because we were all slaves, and here's a very, very challenging question. If you have a note, to make it as a question, it's a talking point. I'll give you a number of talking points as we go through. You don't have to use all of them, because then you'll never get to the matzah. You'll never get through. You'll have to use your judgment. Use your judgment, so you save one for the next night. Well, whatever you feel the audience might like. It's making an astounding statement. What's the astounding statement? We're saying that we were slaves. We're saying we. Well, we weren't slaves. Were we slaves? We weren't. I never had the experience. But actually it's saying we were slaves. And had God not taken our fathers out of Egypt, then we and our children and children's children would have still been enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Is that true? I mean, this is something which happened 3,500 years ago. And you mean to say that the Egypt is gone, Pharaoh is gone, the whole world has changed upside down. Every people has been, they're not even around, or... How is it possible to say that we would still be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt? Yet that's what it's saying. And because that's the case, since it's true that had God not done it to our ancestors, that we would still be slaves, that's why I have an obligation to tell the story. So it's not an answer. It's merely explaining to you why you have an obligation to tell the story. That's Avadim Hayinu. Okay? So bear with me. I'm not going to give you the answer to the question I just raised. Okay, I'm just trying to give you an outline. And what does it say at the end? Again, it's talking about the mitzvah, because you might think, okay, I understand why it's important for me to know the story, but if I know the story, do I still have to get involved? Why do I have to keep telling the same story over and over again? Somebody one time asked me that. You said the same story last year. Ah, so it's saying that the fact that I know the story is not enough. There's many, many important ideas in terms of our faith, in terms of our religiosity, that the story contains, so that even if you're very wise, and even if you still have to do this mitzvah. That's the paragraph of Adam Hayinu. Now, this is followed with the story of the great rabbis that spent the entire night in Bnei Brak until their students came and told them that they woke them up, and reminded them that the time for the Kriya Shema in the morning has arrived. What's the point of that? What's the point of that story? Got to see the logical development. Who cares? It's a story. It's a nice story. Why? What's it doing over here? Ah, it's telling you about these are the greatest rabbis. Didn't we just learn that even if we're wise, right, and even if we know, still it's endless. A person should never consider himself to be wise. It's all relative. The wise person, in his own mind, he's humble, and he realizes that there's more that he can learn. So it's being illustrated by this story. Here you have a collection of the greatest rabbis, and they were so immersed in the telling of the story that they lost track of time. They forgot about a mitzvah, right? Can you imagine a thing like that? These great rabbis forgot about the important mitzvah of Kriya Shema? Ah, that's a whole different attitude. That means this is really the experience. That to be able to get completely immersed and have such a profound discussion that you lose track of time. They lost track of time. That's why you're being told the story. So nobody should ever think that, well, I heard this already, and there's no point in my reviewing it, because that's not the attitude of Judaism. There's always so much that we can learn. Okay, now you have the famous story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Okay, that he says he was like 70 years old, and he never understood a point of Jewish law. Why we recite the Kriyash, the Exodus, why we recite the Exodus at night. And then until Ben Zoma explained it to him. All right, you can go through that on your own. What's the point of that? I'm just trying to give you the connecting links. Why do I care? Why do I care that he was 70 years old? And why do I care that he's telling you that he finally, somebody explained to him? Well, isn't that an amazing thing? Doesn't it show you that the greatest rabbi didn't know something? That's the sign of greatness. Very rare, I mean, a lot of people, very rare, you can find a rabbi who's going to admit that he doesn't know something. Yeah.
I also heard it's also a testament to the power of minhagim, keeping customs even if you're not aware of the rationale behind them.
Okay, fine, that's true. But I think the main thing is that he's telling you that even the Judaism is such that nobody can say, I have all the answers. There's no such thing. And that illustrates the point. It illustrates the point that there's always something new that you can learn. Okay? Now we get to the next. This is very, very important. The four sons. Because as I said, the Haggadah contains within it an explanation of how to do the mitzvah. And the four sons is very important. What do you see from that? What do you see from that? There are four sons. One is the wise son. One is the Rasha, the wicked son. One is the simple son. And one is the Eini Yodea, does not know to ask. Does not know to ask. It's an amazing thing. So it's saying that in order to do the mitzvah of telling the story, you have to understand education. The Torah here is going to reveal its educational philosophy. What's the educational philosophy? Also, who's missing? Which son is missing? There's the Rasha means wicked, right? So that seems like a moral judgment. Well, where's the righteous? Is there a righteous on the other side of the coin? There's no righteous child here. Mm. Isn't that a good question? I mean, either they're being judged intellectually, so you have the Chacham is wise, then you have the simple one, then you have the one that doesn't know to ask. That's intellectual breakdown. So then the Rasha is not an intellectual breakdown. The Rasha is very smart. That's a moral breakdown. So if you're breaking it down on the moral, why don't you have on the other side, the Tzaddik? What about the righteous son? How come there's no righteous son over here? That tells you something. That's a good question. Well, that's the point. The point is to try and get a good question. Okay. Do I have to give answers to? Or just leave it? Is my objective just to give you the questions, then you could have a discussion about these things? I'll give you a little bit, but you know. Let's ask another question. What is it that defines the Chacham? The Chacham, take a look at the Chacham. What does he say? What are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments which the Eternal, our God, has commanded to you? That's a Chacham? That makes him a Chacham. Where's the wisdom? He's just asking a question. He's asking a question. So you see that the philosophy of Judaism is that the most important tool... You see, first of all, also, that what does Judaism value the most? What is the real pursuit of a person? What did God create a human being for? What is the ultimate objective is wisdom, to obtain wisdom. Well, everything flows from that. Oh, thanks. Everything flows. See, that's goodness. The good person is the one who's in tune with the purpose for which he was created. Why did God endow us with a divine soul? Which differentiates us from animals. So we have instincts, we have emotions, and so on and so forth. And however, other creatures have that too. What makes man unique is the divine soul, which gives him the capability of understanding the wisdom that God implanted into the universe, the wisdom of the universe, the wisdom of Torah. See, that's the righteous son. The one who has the appropriate attitude towards the obtainment of the greatest good is the Chacham. And Judaism maintains he's a Chacham because he asks the right questions. Asking the right questions is the most significant thing. To train yourself to be able... The greatest thinkers were the ones who formulated the questions properly. I think that's why a lot of the great scientists were Jews, that Talmudic training to be able to probe, not to accept, to question, but to question intelligently. See, the Chacham is questioning intelligently. He's humble. He recognizes that there's a world of ideas, and he breaks it down categorically. He's setting it up so that he can gain an understanding. That's the Chacham. The Rush is negating. He's using the power of questioning he's coming to conclusions. He does not have an open mind. He's come to conclusions before he's even studied the phenomenon. So he's following his own emotional. So therefore, we don't exclude him. I talked about that a couple of Shabbosim ago. But that's the philosophy. One of these great Rabbi, R-A-B-I, a great scientist. So, you know, a lot of parents, when he come home from school, so, you know, parents say, what did you learn today? What did you learn today? His mother used to ask him, what did you ask today? What question did you ask? What question did you ask? So, unfortunately, perhaps in some of the schools, that's something to be concerned about. They discourage children from asking. If the questions are too tough, so very often they make a child. I spoke to the high school, the girls recently. I told them not to be, ask me questions. You know, don't feel ashamed. In certain yeshivos or religious places, they sort of make you feel you have to accept it. If you don't accept it, if you have questions, you feel a little bit ashamed. You're ashamed to ask. You should never be ashamed to ask a question in Judaism. Yeah.
One of the signs of a master teacher in one of the school districts I taught in was you were videotaped and you had this whole big lesson, this dog and pony show, you know, that you did for the district, and all these people were watching you, but the kids had to come up with the question, a good question. You had to set things up so that they asked the question. If they didn't ask that question, you didn't get it. You automatically didn't get the pay raise, you didn't get anything. But you had to get them to ask the right questions.
Now that's
the whole key to education. Right.
That's the philosophy. That's the philosophy of the Torah. And that's why you have the four sons are all in terms of how they relate to questions. Now, for example, the Tom, the simple son, he asks, what's this? And you should say to him, with a mighty hand, God took us out of Egypt from the house of slaves. What's the difference between the wise son and the simple son? See, the Torah is telling you, you can't give the same answer to each child. That is, many people, I see this all the time, that to me a good teacher is someone who can explain it. I've had from time to time my students, they have children, 8, 9, whatever, they take them, they'll sometimes bring them and they'll sit in on a class. And I'm explaining something, and the child will ask me a question on a very complicated, let me see if I can explain this to a little child. If I can explain this to a little child, then I know I got it clear. And to try and find ways that he'll understand it in his context. Now, many people just won't do that. Even adults, if I ask certain people for certain things, they explain it, but they don't get into my mind but someone who tries to explain something, when I'm talking to someone, I'm trying to, if they don't understand it, I'm trying to find out, why don't you understand it? To the best of my ability. I'm not saying that I can explain it to anyone, but that you have to be sensitive to how the child thinks. But most people aren't. This is my way of explaining it. Take it or leave it. If you understand me, you're smart. If you don't, then it's your problem. That's not the philosophy. The simple son is someone who has emotional curiosity, but not intellectual curiosity. What's this? You give him you make it exciting for him. See, the wise son is someone he's got intellectual curiosity. He's looking for an explanation beyond the drama of it. But what about the child? What about the child that's not. He's interested in more of the emotional, the drama. So then you make it exciting to him. Get him involved in the story. It's a very important point, aside from this also, is that, in my opinion, the Haggadah is really saying that these are not static. That is to say, the simple son will become the wise son. Because you have to stimulate. That's what it says about Torah, that the words, machkimas pesi, the words of Torah make wise the simpleton. That is, a lot of the children have tremendous potential, but nobody's really gotten them interested. That's the Ein Yodeh Lishol. The one, what's the last category? He doesn't know to ask. What does that mean, he doesn't know to ask? Either it could mean he's not sufficiently developed intellectually at this point, he doesn't, or it could mean that he's completely indifferent, he's not interested. So what do you have to do? At psachlo. What it's telling you is, you might think that all you need to do is, if the child asks, I'll answer. But if he's not interested, so fine, let's go on. Many people have that attitude. He didn't ask me, he's not interested, let's go on. There's no such thing. You have to find ways to make it interesting to him. See, a lot of the children that aren't interested in school, it's not because they're not intellectually minded. Get them to talk about football, and they can explain in this. If you find something they really, or computers, if you find something that they're interested in, they're brilliant. So it's not that they lack the intellectual; they're not interested in the subject. They don't find anything that's appealing to them. That's what it's telling you, to try and find something to make it appealing to them. See? So there's another very, very important point over here. I just, in the course of discussing it, studying it this year with my students. The one that doesn't know to ask, it could be intellectual, as we mentioned. See, you have to work with his mind. It could be he's just not interested. It's an emotional thing. There could be a third cause. This is a very important statement of the... He could be embarrassed. He could be ashamed. He could be ashamed to ask. The Haggadah is saying that a person has to overcome his embarrassment to ask questions. That's something which is not tenable. That a person should never, and we have to be very, very careful then how we go about answering, because sometimes teachers make a child ashamed. If sometimes the child will ask a quote-unquote stupid question. We're saying there's no such thing, but just by the reaction of the teacher or the parent or whoever it is, you create it so he feels ashamed. By the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say that whenever someone asks a rabbi a question, the rabbi shouldn't give the answer right away, even if it's a simple question. He should always say, that's a good question, and let me think about it. By the way, that's what I say all the time, because I do have to think about it. But now you'll never know whether I really have to think about it or I'm just saying, no, but what's the reason? Because sometimes the answer is, it's simple. What do you mean? You don't mean it in a bad way. But then the person will feel that the question was ridiculous, and then they'll feel ashamed of the fact they asked the question. So next time they won't ask the question. So it's an amazing sensitivity that when you answer somebody's question, you want to give the person a little bit of a sense, there's a pretty good question. Why? Because the most important thing is that the person should feel confident to ask. And that's a big problem. I mean, I know, go back in my childhood, and you know, a very, you have to fight that emotion. You know, you feel it's a stupid question, or why, or you know, somebody else would have mentioned it. Whatever it is, I'm sure we've all had that feeling in various contexts of a question, something is bothering you, but everybody else doesn't seem to have the problem, so you don't want to ask because there's something wrong with me. I'm sure we've all had that. I can't be the only one that's had that. So that's something you have to combat in life. You have to be willing to, whatever it is, even if you look foolish, it doesn't matter. So you'll look foolish, but you'll understand. Don't be afraid. Judaism frowns upon that. Never make a kid or anybody, not even an adult, feel foolish for asking a question. Okay, let's see if we can continue now. We're still the handbook. This is just the handbook. We never got into the story. We learned why we have to tell the story, okay? And we had some illustrations. Then we learned about the communicating it to the children, and we had the different types of children, okay? When do we actually start? On page 13. Yeah, a little musical accompaniment is good, too. We'll stop. Then you stop and we'll all sing and dance. You know, that's not a bad, that's a change. That's a good change. I'm serious. Okay, now, here's a good one. Where do we start the actual story? Page 13. Mitchila, originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers, and now God has brought us close to his service. And then, it's interesting that everything we say on this night, we say it, and then we usually back it up with biblical verses. Okay? Now, what's this? How is this fitting in? What are we doing here? What does that have to do with the Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim? What does this have to do with telling the story of the Exodus? We're going back to who? Who of our ancestors were idol worshippers? Yeah, Avram came from idol worshippers. It's a very humbling thought. Abraham, our great father, he came, his father was an idol worshipper. The truth is Abraham himself was an idol worshipper. He worshipped idols. But why are we talking about it now? What's the point of this? We're supposed to be talking about slavery, Egypt, Pharaoh, okay? Why this? This is very important. You need, in order to fulfill the mitzvah, you need to know the story of Avraham. Okay? Now, the story of Avraham can be found in the Rambam. You can get an English translation. In Laws of Idolatry, he gives the whole history of Avraham. It's fascinating. Chapter 1. It's very, very important because the story of the Exodus fits into a certain context. It's giving you the ultimate reason behind all of this. So you could ask, for example, one of the questions that is the fact that God chose the Jewish people. One of the questions that the talking points, why did God choose the Jews from all the nations? Well, you see, it's going to go back to Abraham. Who was Abraham? What was his achievement in life? Why is Abraham, there's another good talking point, why is Abraham the father of the Jewish people? What did he do? What did he do? Okay, well, of course, you have to go into the Rambam. The fact is he was an idol worshipper. And I'm just giving it to you very, very briefly. You could fill it in. He was an idol worshipper. His parents were idol worshippers because the whole world was steeped in idolatry. The whole world had lost the notion of the God, the creator of the universe. Who discovered God? Abraham. How did he discover God? The Rambam says, by using his mind. By day and by night, he had no teacher. It shows you the incredible power of an individual who's not afraid to question. He questioned that fits in with everything we're learning. He questioned the system. And he tested. He saw that these idols were worthless. They couldn't do anything. But he studied. He saw that there's a pattern. Indeed, his discovery of God was very, very advanced because he saw that there were laws of nature. That everything operates according to laws, and that behind the scenes there must be a source. That's what the Rambam says. He discovered God intellectually, which shows you the incredible power of the divine soul, of the reason of studying, until he was able to recognize that the whole world was false. That's what Ivri. The Ivri means Aver, that Avram was on one side and the entire world was on the other side. So, and what did he do when he made that discovery? What did he do? What was the? He started to have debates. He started to refute. He destroyed the idols. He wasn't content to keep this truth, this redeeming truth to himself, but he wanted that the kindness, the compassion. He set up a whole system whereby he would help people and invite them for food, and then he would use that to teach them about God. He began to redeem the world from idolatry. That's the purpose of the Jewish people. That's why God related to him. That's why we're the descendants of the fathers. So this phase, you can't tell the story of the Exodus until you tell the story of the origin of the Jewish people. That goes back to Abraham. Okay, it's one little paragraph over here. How much you decide to get involved in that, that's up to you. That's up to your preparation. But it's certainly a key. It's certainly a key to know that everything goes back to Abraham, and then the period of the Avos, the fathers, and he transmits it to Isaac, and Isaac to Jacob, you see? And in very brief, it comes to, this is, blessed is he who keeps his promise to Israel. Okay, what's being introduced over here is the very, very important point. It's called the Bris Ben Absarim, the covenant between the parts. Until, we owe our existence as Jews to the father, to the forefathers. We're just the descendants. God didn't choose us. God chose them. And we are chosen. We as a result of that, we become the Jewish people. And God makes a covenant with Abraham in which, see, here's where it brings it back to the story of the, it brings it back to the story of Egypt. Because the fact that, now, you could ask, this is a very good question. The enslavement, the fact that the Jews were enslaved in Egypt, was this something that just happened? It was sort of like an accident and God redeemed us? Or was this part of a divine plan? Did it have to happen? Was it part of a divine plan? That's a very good question. It could be, you know, and many of the crises that we've experienced could be just circumstances, then God rescues us. Or no, it was God's plan. Well, here you have that God said to Avram, you should know that your children will be strangers in a land which is not theirs. And they will oppress them and afflict them 400 years. 400 years means from the time of the birth of Yitzhak. The enslavement was not 400 years. And also the nation that afflicts them I will judge. And afterwards they'll go out with great wealth. There's so many things you could pick up on over here. But what would you say then? It seems like this was sort of like had to happen, correct? Because he's telling him it's going to happen. What was the purpose? Isn't that a very important question? The whole thing talks about the enslavement and the fact that God freed us. But why was it important that we should be slaves in the first place?
So we know what good is. So we know.
You mean the Jewish people could not have come into existence without being enslaved? What was the reason for that? Besides, but one second. You don't have to answer me. I'm just giving you a good question. Either think about it. I can give you my opinion. I have an answer. But if you insist. But what I'm trying to get you to realize, I can't give all the answers. That to really have a good Seder is to be a little bit creative. If you would break for 15, 20 minutes, you would have good answers would come to the fore. You're starting off with something, you would add something. And at the end of 15 minutes, say, you'd have something. Then you had a good Seder. You don't have to get, there's no such thing as the final answer, but you got closer to it because you'd be involved in a real discussion. I think that, put that on your list. Think about it a little bit. And I don't want to just give answers. I can give you an answer. But then it's a script. This is the question, here's the answer, let's move on to the next point. That's not the idea. I am trying to, if you're familiar, with the general background, then you'll have a creative Seder. Okay, but let's continue now. And then you have the divine promise. The divine promise that, it's not just Paro. That's what the Megillah is saying. What God said to Abraham is a theme that runs throughout the entire Jewish history. And that's in the next piece on page 14. And it is that promise that has been the support of our ancestors. It means to say that that promise was not just limited to that historical period, but throughout all of Jewish history, the promise that that God would also judge the... It's telling you about anti-Semitism. It's introducing you to, and this is a very good topic to say, well, is anti-Semitism a thing of the past, or is it an eternal phenomenon? What the God is saying over here is, look, that Shelo Echad Bilvad Amar Elisheb Chol Dor V'Dor. In every generation, they stand up against us to destroy us. That's a powerful statement. Why is that? It's true historically. in every generation means that anti-Semitism, every generation has its own culture, it changes. There's so many changes going on. There's so much progress that mankind has made. But anti-Semitism apparently is still a danger. And God rescues us from their hands. So it's telling you that, well, that you could ask that these are questions to discuss. Well, why is it that anti-Semitism, is it still alive today? Is anti-Semitism alive today? I think it is. Okay, it masquerades itself as anti-Israel. Well, why? Why is the whole world fixated on Israel? It's an amazing kind of phenomenon. Why? And will it ever go away? Is that something that's eternal? Will there ever be a point in history where anti-Semitism will be removed? These are some of the questions that their God is talking about. It's saying, but it is telling us that without the divine promise, without the protection of God, then the Jewish people could not survive. These are very important points. And then the illustration is the case of Lavan. That it's telling you that there are that we should be able to recognize the divine, even in the case of Lavan, who doesn't seem to be such a terrible person compared to Paro, but it's telling you that if it were not for the divine promise, his real objective was to destroy Jacob. And he wasn't successful because of the divine promise. Okay, let me just skip over some things now. This has segued. We're now in the process of telling over the story. Okay, and the way you're going to tell over the story is Tzei ulamad, go and learn. It recounts. It takes a chapter in the Torah, which is in the Devarim, which is in Deuteronomy, all right? And it studies every aspect of that parsha. Okay, that's when you brought Bikurim, when a person brought first fruits, he would recount in brief the brief history of the enslavement and the fact that God freed us. Okay, so it goes through that, that we went down to Egypt. I'll give you just the headings. Vayered Mitzrayma, why we went down to Egypt. What were the circumstances that we went to Egypt? Then you have another fascinating thing, that the Egyptians turned against us. We developed into a nation in Egypt. 70 souls, we developed into a nation. The fact that the Egyptians turned against us, that's an amazing thing. And this repeats itself time and time again throughout history. How many times in history were the Jews invited in to a country because they needed their help economically? And after the Jews became successful and wealthy, then they turned again. You saw that in the case by Lavan turned against Yaakov, when Yaakov became very successful. You saw the same thing. They invited them down. Paro invited Yosef and all the good. That the Jewish people did good, Yaakov did good for Lavan, turned against them. The Jews did good for the Egyptians, turned against them. In Spanish, in the Middle Ages, Spain, all the various countries, the same pattern is repeating itself over and over and over again. And the Egyptians turned against us. They dealt evilly with us. And then we cried out to God. We cried out to God. That's an extremely important point. That God did not just jump in and rescue us until we came back to our senses, until we reached out for God's help. And then you get into the story of the God's intervention. Okay, page 16. I'm going a little quickly now, just to because it's late. The fact that God took us out with the miracles. So God revealed himself to us. Of course, good question. What was the purpose of the 10 plagues? Why did God inflict the 10 plagues? Why couldn't God take the Jews out of Egypt without inflicting any plagues? God could have caused the darkness and they could have left. What was the purpose of the 10 plagues? Okay. What is the meaning of the fact that and I passed over Egypt, I and not an angel? And I smote every firstborn, I and not a seraph, is another kind of angel. What was the idea behind that? What do you mean, I and not an angel? Let me just give a quick explanation on that. Just a quick one. It means that there was something unique about the smiting of the firstborn, that God did it himself and not an angel. means the other nine ones was through an angel. What does that mean? See, it means that there was this crushed the Egyptians. All of the other plagues manifested itself through something that existed in nature, an aberration, whether it was locusts or it was the water turned to blood, things of that sort. So it meant that that's the angel, that God operated through certain natural forces. Now, as long as God is operating through a certain natural force, a person could escape it, or he could also deny it. Okay, so it's something. How do I know it's a God? Maybe it's just I didn't know that. It's a freak of nature. People will always the hail. Okay, we've never seen hail like that before. It's a freak of nature. It was through an angel. So those who wanted to deny could deny, but you couldn't deny the because there was no natural force in the smiting of the firstborn. Because there's how was it that this house, that there's no plague on earth that directs itself just to firstborn? You can't attribute it to a natural force. It's an impossibility. The firstborn in the house of Paro to the firstborn in the who was a captive. That's what it means. I personally, not through the medium of any particular force. You see, that's what that part means. It was a very unique manifestation. So that's what nobody could deny it. Okay, then I'm sorry?
Not even the History Channel.
Okay. Let me just briefly mention a few more things. You have the Dayenu. You see, you're going into the next phase now. The telling of the story is not just a historical phenomenon. You're supposed to fulfill the obligation that in every generation a person is supposed to see it as though he himself went out of Egypt. Okay? You're going to read about that on page 23. In every generation, a person is obliged to view it as though he himself went out of Egypt. That's extremely important. Okay, and again, I would throw that out to the people. What do you mean? What am I supposed to fantasize? I wasn't there. What do you mean I'm supposed to view it as though? How do I fulfill that? It's a very important thing. Okay? All right, so it means that there's two kinds of stories. You could tell a story, for example, let's say the blacks obtained their freedom in America. But let's say that the people today, the fact that Lincoln freed their parents is not something that they have to give thanks for. Because let's say by this time everybody would have been free anyway. You see? So therefore it doesn't matter. I mean, it's nice, it happened to my parents, but it didn't happen to me because I don't identify. I would have been free regardless. Because new forces were going to come along. What we're saying over here is that this is our story of freedom. That the event that happened to them is just as relevant. My life, I would have had a life of a slave. Whether you take it as a physical slave, or whether you take it as someone who wouldn't have had the Torah, and would be living a life, a meaningless life, a life which is enslaved to his emotions and instincts. In other words, this is my story, this is my history. I've got to attach this story to myself. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. I'll tell you why it's not an easy. But the practical consequence is, therefore, I'm obligated to take a look at the next thing. I have to give praise to God for this. Because God, when you took them out, I benefited from it. I have my freedom. I'm a Jew. I have Torah. I'm a member of the Jewish people. You see what's difficult about this? If a person doesn't appreciate Judaism, how can he get excited about the Seder? That's the problem. It seems to me that this is because the objective over here is to break out in praise, and we're going to say Hallel and praise God and celebrate and be happy. You got to be happy. The purpose of the whole thing is to be happy. Well, happy at what? Happy that you're a Jew. So that's another significant thing. What does being Jewish mean to you at the table? I mean, is it something which makes you happy? What do you like about you? That is really what. Otherwise, what are you saying over here? What are you praising God for? People that are turned off from Judaism are going to have a hard time. But that does. They can understand the idea, though. I mean, a person should be honest. I may not feel that way. I mean, I feel that way. I'm very happy. I'm happy. I like Judaism. But not everybody feels the way I do. Yeah. Isn't it good to know that you have a rabbi that likes Judaism? What, you think all rabbis do? That you think all rabbis do? Excuse me? Well, then why are they trying to change it and rewrite the whole thing? But all right, that's a different discussion. That's provocative. I'm being provocative. Yes. You're supposed to be provocative with the Seder. You're supposed to be provocative. Yes, get people's attention. Not
but
insulting anyone.
But the person that doesn't really fully believe in God. Or
so he can be there. He's there. Everybody's invited. Let him see. Let him hear the idea. Okay. He says, I don't agree. No, you don't agree. So what are you so excited about Judaism? He's going to ask you that. That's what we call the Rosh. He's going to ask you. So you're excited. So tell me, what do you like about you? Why should I be Jewish? That's the kind of discussion. But I do believe that the ultimate objective of all of this is that we're giving praise to God. I view myself as though I got my freedom because the Torah is freedom. Ah, it's another thing to discuss. What's the Torah's idea of freedom? Rabbi Soloveitchik said that what really happened was we were slaves to Paro, and in exchange we didn't just go free, we now became servants to Hashem. Ah, so that's our idea. So that's a good question. How is that freedom? The fact that we're servants to Hashem, how do we understand that? That's our freedom. Yes.
Doesn't the Rambam say that I think it's called a mumar is not allowed at a seder?
At a seder?
Yeah. A person is a rejects everything.
Yeah, but you see, that's if he rejects everything in this day and age, we don't have a true mumar. Like he's saying, someone is completely rebellious, because it means that he just didn't receive the proper education. So you know, we don't treat him that way. We treat him with love because it's not his fault. He was raised with that philosophy. You know, he's not someone who's like a rebellious against God. He just never had like a person today in America that's not religious, that's turned off. It's not his fault. It's assimilation.
What if a person was, raised with?
Well, then you know, it could be. If he's really arrogant, yeah, right. If you look, then why would you invite such a person to a seder? If he's really angry and arrogant, he's just going to spoil the whole seder. I wouldn't invite him. David?
Why would he show up if he didn't have some interest?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Exactly. Exactly. That's the point. If the person, if a person is coming to the Seder, I'm sorry?
No, great brisket.
Good food, good wine. No, but there could be someone, if there is an individual whose basic purpose is just to spoil it for everybody, that I wouldn't want to invite him to a Seder. I don't mind anybody coming, even if he doesn't believe. It doesn't bother me at all. I'd like to have a good discussion, and if he's a reasonable person, he may say, look, okay, I learned something. I don't necessarily feel the way you feel, but I hear what you're saying. I think we'll just stop at this point. I've given this so much more. I mean, I haven't covered. I have a bunch of questions. We can continue to talk before the Seder. I can give you, write up some of these questions.
Put some talking points on the
I'm going to try and do that. Or else I'll just walk around the neighborhood, stop off at your house. Oh yeah, it's Rabbi Mann. So you know, like I'll drink that cup. I'll drink all the wine for all you guys. But you see how important it is. I really think it's very important to be able to defend Judaism, to take the time to say if you study it, you'll see how rational it is, how appealing it is, how much sense it makes to the mind. That's something which I think is very, very important. It's another battle I fought my whole life, you know, to present Judaism, to show the rationality of Judaism, which is not really necessarily the most popular approach in this day and age. But this is the Yesid in the Haggadah. The whole Haggadah is about explaining and seeing the reasons, yes.
You didn't get to see it because it was for women only, but the girls' high school put on a performance last night. And the whole idea behind the drama teacher was that she really wanted to instill in the girls that doing the Passover Seder isn't just about remembering or going through, you know, what happened, but that they should understand and feel as if it had happened to them and they were a part of it. So the play was basically a Passover Seder with the whole family, and the youngest daughter, who just, you know, okay, let's get on with it, she goes to open the door for Elijah and finds herself there. She is in Egypt, she's a slave, and each member of her family is a different role in the play, and they kind of go through it, and then the next thing, you know, they're freed, she sees the sea part, everything, and then she ends up back at the Seder and wakes up the whole family to, oh my gosh, we have to live this, we have to reenact it, it's real, you know, yeah. And what happened, and energizing them to be a part of it, and so it's
No, no, I think that's...
That's neat.
That's very, very important. I think I'm going to stop here because it's late. I appreciate that you all came out. Hold on a second. I do suggest, though, is that this is a very good practical haggadah. But in preparation, there are certain haggadahs that with great explanations. This is the Rabbi Soloveitchik haggadah. He didn't write the commentary. They culled it from different things and they put it, you know, attached it. This is it's called Exalted Evening. There's another one also with commentary of Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is if you can get it. It's kind of late in the day, but I don't know. Is there a bookstore around here? If you can get a Jewish, or you can get it online. It's called the Haggadah with Answers. The Haggadah with Answers. It's got a tremendous amount of questions. And have you seen it? I have it, but I can't. I don't have access to it because I haven't been able to unpack my books yet.
Michael Freeman.
Okay, the Haggadah with Answers. If you can get whoever wants it, because it's got a lot of questions and just good, concise answers that, you know, can serve as talking points, as I've said. Also, this is the Kol Dodi Haggadah, Rabbi Feinstein's son. What's very unique about this is it has a compendium of the practical guide in terms of the laws of the Seder, before the Haggadah. So, the more you read, the more you prepare. I mean, I'm hoping, I'll try if I can get some stuff out there, some more written stuff to help you. But again and again, I think that you take that plunge. Don't feel you have to be scripted. Don't feel you have to have the exact answer. Get involved in a discussion and come up with some answers. We could discuss it afterwards. Maybe you learned that your answer was good. Maybe you learned that there's a better answer. It doesn't matter. The fact that you were involved is very, very important. So I hope you all have an enjoyable and a spontaneous a Passover Seder this year. Okay.